Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It's November 18th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 524. I'm your host, Rob Zachney, and I'm joined by Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
Renata Price.
Howdy.
Kato is off on assignment, so we are going to start with... Actually, Patrick, you are wearing a Kirkland signature hoodie.
I am.
It looks like we picked you up from Costco on the way home and brought you to our podcast.
Well, at Costco, I've never, for the many things I have purchased at the Costco, it is rarely closed despite them frequently having like some pretty decent, clothing wear because they don't carry my size in stock at the store. Like I am generally a small and respect to Costco. Like their sizes tend to go larger, like more broadly. Like, so I'm sitting there going through the stack of everything. Like, well, there's gotta be at least one small in here and there never is. And the solution to that is apparently, as someone told me, you just order it online. So when I saw the Kirkland signature sweatshirt hoodie for $20-something, I got on it.
Much like Patrick Klepek, Kirkland Signature is a name you can trust. Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't going to read this letter, but now that you're wearing the sweatshirt, I feel like I'm now summoned to.
Okay.
Remember on election day, we had a little aside about that weird vote that we had in Massachusetts about like liquor licensing laws.
Yeah.
And I ended up voting for the option that's like, yeah, you can't just keep letting chain stores buy up liquor licenses, et cetera, et cetera. Listener Mike wrote in, "Hey gang, listening to Rob talk about his back and forth on his decision about liquor license, I wanted to point out something that he may not have factored in.
Uh-oh.
While it's too late now, maybe I can help with future alcohol-related voting decisions."
Wait, before you do this, what was the result?
I think my side won, actually. The side I voted
your side
for.
Won, but your side lost? Is that what we're about
possible.
To discover
That's where we're going
through
this
email?
Let me see here. Massachusetts question.
Well, you know what they say. You win some, others, not some.
I mean, this is the nature of, like, ballot measures and things like this. I mean...
The no vote won.
So we're good. You were saved?
So we're good. We are saved from, because here are the stakes.
All right, hit us.
Mike explains, "I live in Maryland where we have a similar law. Something like only one store in a grocery chain can hold a liquor license. The end result is that a lot of chains don't even bother selling beer or wine, which is largely fine as mom and pop liquor stores are in abundance, but there's a very special kind of alcohol that you will lose out on if chain stores can't get a liquor license."
Mm-hmm.
"The Kirkland brand."
That's
right. "Since most chain stores don't bother dealing with the law and opt not to sell alcohol at all here in Maryland, I lose out on everything. Trader Joe's fine Botswin and Joseph Brow varieties? Not
hey,
here.
Hey, Trader Joe's had like their like in-house like whiskeys and Scott, like they are dirt ass cheap. Like a big bottle, like $18, like, and it's higher quality than some of the cost of, you know. Anyway, that is a legitimate bummer. I always buy one every time I'm at the Trader Joe's.
Aldi's Kinru Blue and Wine Advent calendars. Hope you want to drive to Virginia, and perhaps more importantly to the Waypoint audience, Kirkland's fine liquor selection can't be found anywhere here.
Damn,
it's a big bummer because most of these store exclusive brands are great. But since it's too much of a hassle to figure out which one store you want to get a license for, I haven't seen a single Trader Joe's, Aldi, or Costco in Maryland who carries their in-house brands. So a vote for mom and pop, while admirable, may end up costing you that Kirkland signature taste you love. Just something to think about. Keep up the great work.
Now, Patrick, can I ask you some questions? So do you frequently purchase Kirkland signature alcohol, or is this something you've quite... Okay.
No, my main...
Kirkland signature booze?
Yeah, so my... I've not particularly liked the Kirkland brand beers, like the ones I've tried have not done anything for me, so I usually get those at a actual local place, but my go-to, I have like a whole area full of fancy mostly brown liquors. My wife doesn't really drink hard alcohol, mostly drinks wine, and so it's stuff that runs the gamut of like a gift I got that was like $2.50 to the cheapest, which is the Costco stuff. And the Costco stuff you can get in, a gallon, like the big boy, and it's $18. And so that is my, not what I'm having on a Friday night. Like I'm sitting down to watch a good movie. Like I really want to appreciate what I'm having. But if it's, I had a hard night with the kids, it's 10 o'clock, I'm going to play a video game. I pour a little bit of the Kirkland. And specifically it doesn't have much bite to it. So I don't, I don't like a lot of ice in my brown liquor. And so I like the fact that I will have like the one that Rob, you just made a face, like the big cube occasionally like to do like, but broadly, I like the full, like I like brown liquors that I can just taste straight.
So can I just, so here's an eye-opening thing for me. When I was at a Scottish expat bar in Sweden, of all places.
There
was...
So, I'm just going to take that one at face value and let you keep telling that story.
Like,
I love working with Rob Zachney.
So, I had a long night there, and I expected, this is going to be a... This is a temple to scotch, and indeed it was. It was an incredible night. A ton of scotches that don't, it's the same things we run into with distribution laws here. But like, there's just a ton of like scotch liquor that's made that just doesn't get exported, or at least doesn't get exported here because there's no market for it, right? Like Glenlivet is a really well known brand. They're everywhere, but that's a huge distillery compared to a lot of their places. But anyway, while I'm there, this is where I sort of noticed that every single, like, between every two stools on the bar and at every table, there's, like, a small little pitcher with water that people are using to water their whiskey.
Wow.
And this is where I realized, nobody drinks it straight, or you're not supposed to. And the bartender was like, oh, no. Like, if you're drinking it straight, what are we trying to prove here? It's just like all you'll taste is the alcohol. You really got to open it up, my son. And I was like, open it up. Yes. And so like, this is the funny thing. It's not because the thing for me is I don't like necessarily mind. The thing I don't like about like hard liquor on the rocks is that I can get the cold mutes so much of the flavor that it's just
that's broadly my thing is I drink brown liquor because I like the taste, and at least in my limited experience and like limited understanding is that plunking in ice cubes means that I feel like I'm drinking more water than, especially if I paid for something a little more expensive. Right. Again, I could be wrong here. Maybe so, people are dumping gallons of water into their whiskey and that makes it taste better. I don't know. That could just be habit. For sure.
But yeah, so this would be my thing. If like there's ever stuff that you're like, that's too much burn, that's a little too intense. Mm-hmm. It probably is, but like it's not balanced to be like drunk straight. So you should.
Those are the ones where I will. Yeah. Like, yeah, that is like, and the cheaper stuff tends to. Aldi is the one I have not had. The Aldis around me do not sell. I have heard famously that the Aldi's liquors are also. Quite good and quite cheap, but I don't think any laws are preventing that. I just have not driven far enough with the explicit purpose of being that degenerate.
Now, I would like to acknowledge something.
Yes.
Patrick, this conversation about ice, about putting ice in whiskey, you came at Rob and I for our proclaimed love
Mm-hmm. Of the good ice.
Of big ice. Of mm-hmm. good ice. Of big ice. And here we are, months later.
But is Patrick's ice coming from his fridge?
Yes.
But the utility of the ice is important. And this is why the good ice exists, is because the ice is important to the experience. This is mm-hmm. why I have big ice.
I dumped the ice in my water. There were a couple in here earlier. That is broadly the extent of my ice experience.
This is why I have ice orb in yes. my home. I have ice orb for whiskey.
And I have big cube.
Yeah.
Yeah. All this so much corpo talk suddenly just got into the podcast.
Ice orb and big cube.
Are those on the ballot as well? Do we know how those measures went?
Yeah, that was question five. it's deadlocked. They're currently in recounts. Stupid. Anyway, we'll dip back in the question bucket in a bit. Patrick, I saw you did flag a couple news stories. There's one that's obviously near and dear to my heart. I suppose not a huge surprise, but looks like more control is coming.
Yes.
Yeah, Remedy double dips in the news cycle, which is that if you just do a Google search for 2021, you will find that they announced Control 2 back then, and then just reannounce Control. I think it was just
with a 505. Yeah, we signed with 505, which hey, still signing with 505. Okay.
So they formally announced that Remedy is making Control 2. It's got a bigger budget than the game, the prior game, which makes sense. They released some concept art that seemed to suggest it was going outside. I can tell you what I've heard about that game is that it's going outside, and that has some pretty interesting implications for what that game in that world could be. It does seem, it's hard to tell, is Remedy stretched thin, is like the first thought I have from this news, between Alan Wake 2, which is probably, I mean, they've said it's going to come out sometime next year, so closer than we think, if it manages to hit that schedule. The Max Payne 1 and 2, I think they've categorized them as remakes, not remasters. Control 2, a Control multiplayer spinoff, which is a separate project, and then probably something else that is not immediately coming to mind. But that's a lot for a studio that, pre-Control sort of reshaping what Remedy is as a studio. It was doing things like that the campaign for that shooter mm-hmm. that I can't crossfire, essentially yep. to pay the bills.
I mean, yeah, that is, I do wonder how much is going into, like, those remasters.
Right, like, don't expect Max Payne 3. I just don't know. They didn't really say when they announced them what exactly we should expect from them. But given the Alan Wake, I mean, maybe the thought is Alan Wake 2 is in production as that winds down. That shifts yeah. to Control pre-production. And then that is just, like, they essentially have one main game, and then these things orbit around it. That I can see that making sense, as opposed to thinking these are games are being built, you know, in parallel, which means Control 2 is probably some ways off.
They've become a two-team studio.
It's just a matter of what does that mean, yes, right? Like, yes, what is the size of that team, right? Is it two triple A, you know, games to take 3 to 5 years to build, or is it
ooh, they orbit exciting. Around one of could those. Really which shut is Remedy down within 5 years.
Oh God!
No, Alan Wake 2 and Control 2 guaranteed hits. These would be the biggest games of their year.
Guaranteed, yeah. Obviously. Alan Wake, famous blockbuster game.
Everyone loves it.
Yeah, everyone adored Alan Wake. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's definitely not a game that almost sunk the studio as they tried to develop it over the course of 5 to 7 years. Definitely not.
I guess, like, speaking of studio sinkings, did Saints Row sink Volition, or do you think this is just inevitable?
So they announced that Volition is now a subsidiary of Gearbox, which itself is a subsidiary of Embracer. Let me see if I can pull up if there's a quote explaining. I mean, Embracer has said that essentially Saints Row made money, but not in a way that like you got up on a chair and were like, yeah, it was more like if you were looking at a balance sheet, like it was slightly positive, which is not necessarily maybe where they wanted to end up with that series. you know, I don't what this actually means for Volition going forward. I'm not sure. Does this mean that Volition becomes a Borderlands studio? I think it's within the realm of possibility. I don't know what this means for the furthered independence of Volition. It probably means an end to Saints Row. It would be hard for me to imagine that they'd be working on that franchise going forward. And I know that Embracer has said the Tiny Tina Borderlands spinoff was so successful that they want to turn that into a separate franchise. So it wouldn't shock me if Volition like went into some kind of satellite studio role within Gearbox, which I guess if the alternative was that Volition got shut down, this is a better version of that. But I don't know. Yeah, it's weird because it's like it's moving from Deep Silver to Gearbox. So I don't know. Like, it's not like Deep Silver is shutting down. So I don't know what this ultimately. I don't think we know ultimately what that ends up meaning, other than it's Embracer in the news again.
And also just another weird studio situation note. Blizzard games are no longer going to be playable in China as of January 23rd of next year. That's another weird thing that's happening because they have lost. They were not able to come to a new deal with their Chinese publisher, NetEase.
I think games going in and out of that market is fairly common. And
this kind of disruption is weird.
This kind of disruption is weird. Like, but I believe there wasn't an issue over the last couple of years where the government essentially put a stranglehold on even approving new games to make it into the system. I believe that's been an issue for the last, like,
yeah, that had gone on for a couple of years, that they'd like had a period of being pretty, never quite rubber stamp, but pretty fast.
There's a flow of new games coming in. If you, once you kind of like got in good or were part of the process or found a partner, and there was a period over COVID where just new games just weren't coming in parallel with sort of, you know, like a lot of new films are not coming out in China as well.
The note being though that this was this deal had been ongoing for 15 years since 2008, and the inability
I think they were one of the earliest companies to like get their games sold over there.
And so they were unable to come to an agreement. That was that news came out last night. And so 23rd, but they're still releasing the new Hearthstone expansion, the second season of Overwatch 2, and the Dragonflight.
Dragonflight, okay.
Yes.
Are those being operated with a different partner?
No. They are releasing them temporarily, and then they're gone. And the other thing is that Diablo Immortal is still... you can still play Diablo Immortal because Diablo Immortal was co-published with NetEase under a different agreement from everything else.
Weird.
So Diablo Immortal is still playable. Everything else will not be as of January 23rd, unless they can come to a new deal.
I mean, there's still ways to jump through, you know, loopholes to play what you want to play out there, but obviously it is easier when you don't have to to jump through those loopholes. And I'm sure that's more complicated with online games.
So I was just looking up, because I'm always, anytime Volition moves, I'm like, I wonder if anyone out there would want to make another Free Space game. And, you know, Gearbox might with the embrace of the Homeworld franchise.
Gosh, Free Space. Is that pre-Red Faction, or is that in parallel with Red
That's
Faction?
That's pre.
Rob, you have such a beautiful heart. It's so big and it's so big and strong. And I'm so glad it's here and that we have it. You
it
know?
Contains space for places like Free Space 20 some years later. I mean, it could come back.
Well, why not let them make a, you know, just slap Homeworld on it? Homeworld: Free Space.
I mean, the thing is, of course, none of those people exist probably anymore at the studio.
The Saints Row team left.
Institutional memory of making a space shooter. Somebody wants to slap Homeworld on a Free Space type game, I'm all the way in. Absolutely. So the other thing we alluded to this the other week that Mick Gordon, composer on Doom Eternal, had published a pretty epic accounting of his view of how things went sour with that soundtrack, with working with Id, in response to him feeling that he'd sort of been thrown under the bus.
Well, and very specifically, if you want to like grind down like the shortest version of this story is that the composer of Doom Eternal, Mick Gordon, had a dispute with Marty Stratton, the head of Id Software, and rather than all being dealt with privately, Marty Stratton went and on Reddit and wrote a post like burying Mick Gordon and sent a lot of as a result, fans are going to do it. When you go to the Doom subreddit, what's going to happen? Well, a lot of targeted harassment, smearing of Mick Gordon's name and work, like regardless of the facts of the situation. And so like, that's where like a huge amount of this tension comes from is, lots of issues happen in private that are ugly and bad and tied up in money and creative choices. What was different was this spilling onto the public in a very one-sided affair than just recently, but also years later, Mick Gordon outlining in a very lawyerly fashion, also very lawyerly read fashion.
With a meticulous, meticulous selection of receipts. Like it's worth
it's
fascinating just as a document incredible. Of how like game soundtracks get made. Like obviously this is a case where it goes bad, but it's actually really eye-opening in terms of like one thing he centers on is early on he had a feeling that they were off on the because he's done this before. He had a feeling they were off on the wrong track with how you order up a soundtrack like this. He was like they requested final music from him with a ton of the game not finished, and he was like, this is just not going to work, especially because a mandate for this game is that it has to be scored all the way through. And so sure enough, that didn't work out, but he outlines the entire series of exchanges they have where he tries to pitch a different idea. It all goes south, but like it's a fascinating accounting in addition to, a pretty brutal, belated reply to Marty Stratton.
And then Bethesda, ZeniMax, Id Software didn't really respond in the moment. And their response to this was to issue a statement on Bethesda's Twitter account, which reads as follows. The recent post by Mick Gordon both mischaracterized and misrepresented the team at Id Software, the development of Doom Eternal, Marty Stratton, and Trad Mossholder with one-sided and unjust account of an irreparable professional relationship. We are aware of all the details and history in this matter and unequivocally support Marty, Chad, and the team at Id Software. We reject the distortion of the truth and selective presentation of incomplete, quote, facts. We stand ready with full and completed documented evidence to disclose in an appropriate venue as needed. The statements posted online have incited harassment and threats of violence against Marty, Chad, and the Id Software team. Any threats or harassment directed towards members of our teams will be met with swift and appropriate action to protect their health and safety. Remain incredibly proud of Id's previous collaborations with Mick Gordon and ask that fans refrain from reaching conclusions based on his account and, more importantly, from attacking any of the individuals mentioned on either side, including Marty, Chad, or Mick. You will notice nothing in there responding specifically to any of the points. Broadly, the thing here is we're mad that you said something and then people got mad at us. Again, we can't know a full accounting of the facts. Like, this is turning into a real ugly and messy sort of he said she said, but actually there is no she said in this response with Bethesda. It's just we're mad. Why'd you do that to us, Mick? And it's like, because you went public in the first place. None of this had to happen this way, but then Gordon felt the need to respond in the venue that they responded, and just blaming it all on harassment seems like they're using that as a shield in a way that feels pretty inappropriate.
There's a weird, I've seen this crop up in a few places now where, so one, obviously like any sort of public facing role, people who represent companies or people who are in the public eye deal with a higher level of just like nasty shit coming their way, but then also when there is something that paints targets on them or their institution, there is a wave of like greater abuse or harassment that does tend to follow, and it's particularly bad in games, and this is all true. But I've also seen a trend here and elsewhere in like corporate comms. I see this a bit in F1 social media spaces as well, where there's a real quick reach for like the harassment aspect of stuff to shut down a discussion of something you no longer want to talk about, where it's like, we're not going to talk about this and we condemn harassment of anyone involved in the situation. But really the operative part is we don't want to talk about this anymore. Right. And that is the function to serve in the statement.
Yeah. And it ignores that the only reason we're in this situation at all, putting aside the behind the scenes negotiations, is Marty at Software publishing a public Reddit post, like going after Mick Gordon and creating the targeted harassment in the first place. So you can't sit here and go, Mick, why are you doing this in public? This is just inciting the fans to go after the people you collaborated with, when that's what they did in the first place. I mean, like, one of the first responses that pops up for me in my Twitter feed is David Goldfarb, who's one of the designers or the creative director on Metal Hellsinger, a game that itself, has a deep touchstone with the style of similar styles of music that was in Doom Eternal, and writes what I think was pretty succinctly. So go ahead and clarify or refute these points. Marty opened Pandora's box. He might as well attempt to close it. And I mean, he's right. I mean, you can't, like, they're just pretending they were not complicit in how we arrive at this moment in terms of the public discourse and interaction of it. Again, the facts that Mick lays out seem pretty compelling, but it is also possible that there is selective receipts to try and paint a narrative. Yeah. It's all possible. Absolutely. Like, this happens constantly. Like, just look at the Bayonetta situation. There's a world where it's just a very good version of that. But at the end of the day, like, Marty chose violence by going to the subreddit and doing it that way. You can't then suddenly, cry foul when the person you called out, eventually responds.
It's so weird that to borrow Goldfarb's turn of phrase, that Marty even opened this Pandora's box in the first place, right? Like, the game shift, it exists. Like, why are we doing this? Like, mm-hmm. why was it important to pick this fight in the first place? Is a little bit confusing, but obviously, I guess it does dovetail with this relationship. It got very personally very bad.
Yes.
And this is the result. But yeah, it seems like, between the lines, Bethesda doesn't want to talk about this anymore. It doesn't.
Well, and then also, like, do it in court, right? Yeah. Like, I think it's like sort of like where they're drawing the line, as if, and it not unreasonable to just say that you will respond to it formally, and like, by appropriate venue, they mean so sue us. But to issue like this lengthy statement, it's one thing to respond and say, we're proud of our collaborations, but we'll deal with this in the appropriate venue. That's one thing. This is itself another firing back in a way that is only going to, at the end of the day, whoever is right, Bethesda looks bad, right? Yeah. Like, however the facts actually are, if we had them all in front of us, there's not a world where you come away from this situation feeling any sort of sympathy for the id Software Bethesda side. You just come away thinking you should just pay Mick Gordon his money. And that shows a real mishandling and misreading of the situation from their side.
Last thing I wanted to hit, it's not really my beat. I wish Cod over here is as well. But so the Pokemon Scarlet and Violet is apparently a disaster, you're saying, or at least like performance-wise, it's going very poorly.
It seems to be an excellent game that is a borderline unplayable in a lot of spots, according to a lot of the reviews that have dropped. Hopefully, if Kato could be here, Kato could not even speak to the game, because the way Nintendo, you don't know if you're going to get a Nintendo game early. If you are Waypoint, you might get it on the day of, you might get it a month in advance, you might get it a week before. Pokemon tends to drop for us the day of. So hopefully I'll be able to hand a code to Kato so they'll be able to check it out over the weekend. But, we mentioned this when we were discussing Bayonetta 3, a game that itself seemed to be struggling against the technical constraints of the Switch. I know, Ren, one of your points was that, like, the art direction is not a problem. It seems frequently the restraints of the technology force the art in a certain direction that end up dragging the overall project down. This seems to be even more like the open world Pokemon game that came out at the start of this year, oh, I don't know how to say that.
Pokemon Legends Arceus.
There, that one. You know, that game had technical issues, but was, you know, one of those things. Well, hopefully they'll figure it out as they go along. This one has just, like, really rampant. It seems either it was rushed and or the Switch itself is really holding it back to a point where, you know, you're seeing folks where, like, well, and it's weird where, like, the game is really good by all accounts, but that it's like, well, you could imagine a lot of people just wondering, should I find other ways to play this exact game once it's out? And once you see people starting to talk in that direction, you know, Nintendo might have a problem. Not to the extent that this game won't sell exceptionally well. It will. It'll do just fine. But this is clearly becoming like a pretty important narrative across where there are reviews like in The Guardian. Essentially, they said this game's awesome. It's extremely hard to play, 3 out of 5. So like you're getting games marked down, yeah. You know, multiple points, whatever stock you put that in, because the act of playing it is difficult. And that's an unfortunate place to be for a game that otherwise seems pretty all right.
I mean, I think the messy thing is that, like, they're in this really awkward position because, like, Game Freak is technically, if I remember correctly, technically not Nintendo. And the thing Correct. That seems to be the state of the Switch right now is that the Nintendo Switch is perfectly technically competent for basically anything that Nintendo actually develops because they know how to actually develop for it, and no one else, or like people are barely able to get to that level of like technical stability across the rest of the industry, right? This is happening with Platinum, and the Switch.
Right.
And like you can get more out of this hardware technically. Game Freak sure doesn't know how to fucking do it. No one knows how to do it other than Nintendo. And it seems like Nintendo's been like, it's fine because it works for us in a way that is, I think, very frustrating and has to be frustrating for other developers.
Right. And Game Freak has never been a studio that prior to this moment is known for being a technical powerhouse. Their games have always been technically pretty simple, but the gameplay was good. The creatures were cute and people were happy or happy enough with that. And what's happened here is that you finally have the studio making games with the scope and ambition that people have wanted from Pokemon for literally decades. And it's being dragged down, not just in like technical performance, but like the environments themselves are just empty of any life. For a world that should be full of it. And most likely, if the performance is this poor without it, imagine what it would be like if they tried to do anything like that dropped into the world. And I think, yes, it is probably true that Game Freak is not necessarily getting everything they can out of the machine because they are not tapping into it the same way Nintendo does. But that is true of most developers. And usually the way that works is that, well, the hardware like does some of the work for you, right? A new Switch would make these games run better. Just as though you're putting in a new GPU, right? You need a new graphics card, and the game finally rock solid 60. Not saying that's what you get here, but clearly Game Freak is not able to, for the games they're trying to make and the importance they have for Nintendo as a brand, they're not able to match that. And I'm sure Nintendo could send, the one thing I would push back on, Ren, is that Nintendo could just send the engineers, right? They could parachute people in. And if they're not able to make these games work is the most important release for Nintendo this year. Right. I think that suggests something about anyone's ability to pull them off at this scale.
Right. To be clear, Patrick, I agree with you. I am fully in they need to release a new Switch. And I've been trying to other than just, it's hard to make a new console, suss out why Nintendo has spent 5 years being like, we're not going to release a Switch Pro. Because I it just feels at this point increasingly a confusing decision for the company to make.
Well, there's been the supply chain issues for the past couple of years. In which if you wanted to launch a new Switch, they do not want to be in a Xbox or PlayStation situation where you're having negative financial results because you just cannot make enough of the things. It's nice that people want to buy it, but like it was not a situation where people have accused Nintendo in the past of artificial scarcity because they like that things are hard to find. That's not what Sony and Microsoft were doing during COVID. It was just like, no, we would really like to sell more of these. And so I do think, you know, I was talking about this with Jeff Grubb when I guested on his daily news show Monday over on Giant Bomb, Game Mess Mornings. But it does feel like Nintendo's being squeezed, was being squeezed at multiple ends, in which, or now they're being squeezed at both ends, where it's like the technical stuff is getting away from them. But the supply chain issue stuff is finally like, was it squeezed, but it's finally releasing. And so the hope would be, if those two things can be released by a new, a new model, that I don't know if they'll run these games any better, but at least future games might run more well, or at least give Game Freak more runway to make the games that, clearly people want to play, and this one will sell well. But it's just too bad that the platform is really, it's such a curse. Pokemon fans have literally wanted this exact type of game for so long. And then the Monkey Ball girls, and it's like, sorry, it also runs at 5 frames a second. Wah, right. Wah.
Yeah, it's frustrating because in part because, yes, this refusal to sort of even draw a map for what the succession plan is for the Switch. And instead of sort of pretense that, it's perfectly, well, maybe it would be perfectly serviceable if, like, developers weren't to sort of stay current in the market, needing to push beyond these boundaries that they can comfortably operate within. But yeah, this is where this device seems to have ended up.
That's where you end up with these cloud versions, yeah. Right? Where Resident Evil Village comes to the Switch, but they're just not even gonna bother trying to do it natively. Just please, like, you would actually have a better experience doing it over your crappy Wi-Fi than you would trying to play this on the Switch itself.
So that about does it for news. We should take a quick break here, and then we can talk about some of the games we've been playing. Back after this.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
And we're back. So one thing that Patrick, you and I have been playing is Firaxis' Marvel's Midnight Suns. I'm really gutted that it can't be Sid Meier's Marvel's Midnight Suns with exclamation point. I think that would be a beautiful title. But yeah, Patrick, you and I have both been playing a bit of it. I think you've put a little more time into it. You want to explain what Midnight Suns is? Because I had, I think it was very easy to sort of assume when this first announced that it's like, it's XCOM.
It's not
with Marvel.
It is. One of my first thoughts, and I this is not reflective of my thoughts on the game, is that XCOM fans are going to hate this. Mostly because if you had the impression that even by now that with the hey, we just we're going to take XCOM and we're going to put Marvel characters into it. That is just they have built something fundamentally different. This is Firaxis taking. I don't know if this is representative of where they want to go in the future. My guess it is. My guess is this is a preview of where they would go with an eventual XCOM 3. Midnight Suns, the premise, is I'm not as familiar with the monster side of Marvel, or the demon side of Marvel, but Lilith, a very powerful demon, is back. And the Marvel characters need
somehow
to stop
Lilith
it.
Has returned.
Somehow Lilith has returned. And the way Firaxis sort of, rather than having you just deal with like a team of superheroes, they have created a new player character that called the Hunter. And you might be wondering to
shut the fuck up.
You might be wondering to yourself, well, surely they have like a real name, and the Hunter is just sort of, like Kraven the Hunter or whatever. Like, that's just part of the superhero name. No, there's like a very specific exchange. I don't know if it was optional or you got this one in the main line, Rob, or someone asked, like, well, I think Blade asks, you like, well, what is your real name? The Hunter. Well, okay, but I know people call you that, but like when you were born, what did your mother name you? The Hunter. I was like, okay, so your name is The Hunter, and that is like your blank slate character. There's a little character customization. The game has a bunch of fashion stuff that you're like unlocking as you're playing, and that becomes sort of the player cert, not just the player certificate, but like you are the chosen one. Like you've been resurrected from the dead. You put Lilith away centuries ago and then had to be locked away as a result. And you've been resurrected.
Your hunter's rest.
Yes, the hunter's rest.
I believe is a gag they make in the opening sequence.
Yes. And then you awake, you know, hundreds of years later to try and put Lilith down again alongside you know, a lot of Marvel characters you are probably familiar with, and then others that, you know, if you're mostly familiar with the movies, you probably have not met a bunch of these quite yet. But yeah, it is turn based, but it's not a grid based game. It's a card game. I don't know that it is as hardcore as, you know, a roguelike deck builder as we often talk about here. But it is a game in which you are given a set of cards. Those have abilities on them, and you are playing those over the course of a battle. Movement is way less important in this game. It's actually less about movement as much as it is environmental interactions, where like you are picking up objects and tossing them, or you are taking enemies and you are tossing them into other enemies to create chain reactions. The way movement even, like you can just move freely. Like you get one move turn per turn, and then you can just keep adjusting that as you want. If you want to like try and set up what you might think is like a knockback or a knockdown on a next turn, but broadly like position is not that important.
Feels like the only thing you watch out for is like AOE attacks from enemies, where you're exploding like spread out. But yeah.
But it's actually way more about like each of the enemy types will tell which enemy is targeting who, so you know that in advance. Like when a turn begins, it's like, oh shit, everyone is targeting Ghost Rider, so I need to either buff them or take out the enemies that are targeting them, account for that. It's interesting. I don't know where I fall on it quite yet. Rob, where are you at on it?
So I'm not very far in. I think I am. So here's the thing. The thing I was not expecting also was how talky the game was going to be.
Yeah.
Like, I think if it were like XCOM levels of focus on the tactical stuff, I'm not sure I would love this tactics game like so much to keep my interest. But the fact that it is also a wander around the monastery and talk to all the other Marvel superheroes type game is intriguing to me.
There are dialogue choices. There is a good, bad, or light, dark skill. I don't know exactly how this works yet, but basically you'll be in dialogue. You'll have conversations with folks, and then there'll be like a kind of a neutral response, and then one that has like a white marker and a dark marker.
Right.
And as you fill that up, that can unlock certain. I don't know what that does yet. I just know that it unlocks certain things. I do think it's interesting where, like, broadly, you want to be the good guy. And so you'll hit, you know, respond appropriately with the ones that have the light markers. But then there's this one character, Magic, M-A-G-I-K, who does, like, every time you try and say the nice thing, they get mad at you. And so you have there's also a social layer to it where you are, if you're saying like, we need to save Scarlet Witch, and then the character, and then the game's like, yay, plus one in the light. Or the other response can be, you know, like Scarlet Witch should have known what she was doing. Like, oh, plus one in the dark. With this Magic character, it's like when you were trying to be nice and say the good guy thing, you also loot. They're like, that doesn't actually. What kind of bullshit are you like spouting at me right now? And your friendship will go down with them as a result because they don't think you're being real with them. They think you're just spouting a bunch of bullshit, which is kind of interesting where you feel like you're saying the quote right thing in terms of like being the hero, but actually this character is going to call you that's not how you should treat them if you want your friendship level to go up with them. But we should be clear, you can't fuck any of these characters. I think they said that pretty early on in the game's development cycle.
Fucking cowards.
This is not hooking up to have sex, although there is definitely romance implied. Captain Blade's got a thing for Captain Marvel. He doesn't want to talk about it, but he's got eyes on her. And I'm still not sure how that part. The writing seems like pretty good. It's not like I'm disliking the conversation trees, but I'm with you, Rob, that I'm kind of taken aback how much of the game is that. But I think it almost has to be because the combat layer, which I do quite like, is snappy and more arcadey in a way that I don't know that it will have. We'll have to see, but I don't know that it'll have the same sort of depth that XCOM's combat layer. Like, you could take everything else out of XCOM and like those combat sequences would be right. Like fun on their own. It's unclear to me right now if that would be the case with Midnight Suns.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about it. I think next week you and I are going to be having a conversation with Jake Solomon, the designer on it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get more into this next week. But yeah, right now I'm sort of surprised. I saw Stephen Totello posting, his sort of précis on it is, it's, you know, the Avengers meets Fire Emblem Three Houses, and that's not entirely inaccurate.
No.
for the overall vibe of what's going on. I think the last thing I would say is for how talky it is, we've talked a lot about how Guardians of the Galaxy works in large part because like all that talking is like all just like S tier, right? It's just terrific stuff. Mm-hmm. Here I would say, yeah, it doesn't rise to that level. It's a very lofty level. But since we've seen it recently, this is like the slightly more stilted version of like what they pull off pretty effortlessly in Guardians.
Yeah. And there's so many more characters and like you're building out an enormous roster right off the bat. And, you know, every time, at least in the part where I'm in the game, you know, like 4 or 5 hours in, I'm still tutorializing. Like I'm still being introduced to things. So it suggests to me this game is extremely long and also the roster will get very big. There's even things where, I wonder if the stuff disappears on higher levels, but the game prompted me just now where, so like when the characters you take out with you onto a mission that is also going to increase your friendship level with them as a result of them going with you, and also it opens them up for leveling up, which happens during the combat, like a character will do an action and level up. And the game is like, hey, play with the characters you want to play with, especially if you're developing a social bond with them that you want to kind of like nurture. Like if you still really love Nightcrawler or whatever, like they'll still level up, which is like an interesting choice to make. Whereas in XCOM, that doesn't happen, right? Like a character is left behind. The whole point
is you have to rotate through.
And yeah. Now this game does have, like, I believe if, it hasn't happened to me yet, but it's been alluded to in like the interface of like, oh, hey, this is where characters go, like when they need to recover between missions. So I doubt anyone dies permanently, but I think there will be scenarios where if a mission goes bad, you know, you could have, you know, multiple heroes unavailable for the upcoming mission. But it is interesting that the game is, we want you to use the full roster. These are named characters. We want you to care about them and bring them with. And also probably there are times where, characters are required, and so it'd be sort of weird if like the character you've been ignoring the whole game because you don't really like their power set was functionally useless in a fight 20 hours in. So we'll put more time into it. We'll chat more about it when we kind of set up our Jake Solomon interview next week.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah,
Rob, you said that the combat is very combo heavy. You said, one of you said that the combat was very combo heavy.
It's like chain reactions of things are frequently right. Something you're doing.
Would you say that it is? Is it giving the best parts of Chaos Gate to you, Rob? Like I when you say that, I think about the best moments in Chaos with you and I playing Daemon Hunters together. Where you really get that, like, I am the biggest genius who's ever lived because I successfully set all of these dominoes up, and then my cool super guy absolutely obliterated like six people.
I don't think so. I think it's in part because, so the way it's working is, so you have like, you have three heroes on a mission and they will contribute cards to your deck and you'll draw in a random assortment that will be some representation. Like, you might not just draw a card for one of your heroes on the turn, by the way. They just might sort of be idling because just every other card you drew was for other folks. But the thing that's, like, in play, the way the combos would sort of work in a lot of cases is stuff like, you know, a character, like... This seems particularly prevalent with the skill cards, which are like non-attack cards. But skill cards tend to do things to like buff or transform the deck in some way, or change like outcomes for certain types of actions, and then that will affect what other characters doing with their basic attacks. The other thing is basic attacks build meter that allow heroic actions to take place, and so like. Right now, what I would say is like a lot of the combos I see are pretty like simple, straightforward, like crowd controlling enemies to set them up for big AoE attacks or stuff like that, or leave them in proximity for chain attacks. But it is not quite as difficult to set up the combos. It's not quite as like rigorous as Demon Hunters, and so it's a little bit more like you're just kind of juggling resources rather than necessarily. Like setting the dominoes up and knocking them over.
The cards are pretty basic at this point, though. So, like, that's one thing I'll be curious about going forward is, like, you know, could you kind of stick with these mainline attack decks to kind of just get through the game if you wanted to play it that way? But then what happens once you have cards that are, you know, have longer term consequences or something that you're building towards over two or three turns?
Does it feel more like a tactics game or more like a card game?
I think maybe one of the, we'll have to play more. I think one of the odd things is the answer is no. Like, it feels like it's a bit more like a card game because it is so card driven. But also, I don't feel a strong connection to the deck in the way that you do in like a deck building game, for instance. It is more of a card game, I would say, than a tactics game, but also. It does not necessarily ask the same level of like sculpting of like it's
at least
not
up front
that way,
right? Like that's you know, you certainly have decks, right? Like you can go in and change individual characters and you know alter the randomness of the pull, but it just feels like the game has such a slow on ramp, right? Like it is just being very deliberate in terms of how it's like bringing you into the game.
Well, and the flip side is. You know, to that point, because you can't exert as much control over your deck, you'll also be, like, your hands can look very, very different from one another, like, just turn to turn. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, I guess the thing that it gets is, yes, it doesn't necessarily have the satisfaction of, like, I've carefully crafted this, like, particular stiletto that I'm going to use again and again in battle. And instead, it's much more like, how do you make this group of heroes work together? Because here's just a bunch of random shit in your hand that all, like, you know, it's all stuff they can do. How can you make it work together so they can have a higher impact? Which is kind of interesting and is, you know, as like, deck builders have become more and more the default, sort of this creative aspect of card games can sometimes be left aside a little bit. And this definitely, like, has that and seems to be leaning into that. So... But yeah, to Badger's point, we're both very early hours. Like I saw a preview on this that estimated the game is like a 60-hour game.
It feels like it, right? It feels like the first 10 hours are
60
setting. I mean, XCOM is similar, right? Like 40 to 50. I feel like it took maybe XCOM 60.
Well, 60 is still a lot. Like it's big.
Yes.
Big.
60 is a lot, especially with what it sounds like you are describing.
Well, but this is, we haven't touched on any of the like exploring around side things. Like I don't think it is 60 hours of combat. I think it is probably, you know,
the ratio of story and like doing Marvel shit to combat is pretty high. Like there's a lot of like goofing off it. It's not Avengers HQ, but you know, it might as well be Avengers
HQ. Yeah.
Like,
do you want to go watch a movie with Doctor Strange to, you know, have a little like side exchange with them. Like that's the thing I'm going to be curious over the long haul is like the writing is fine, good even, but this game is so heavily dependent on that aspect of it in a way that is such a opens the game up to a lot more risk than if they had quite literally just made, hey, what if we do XCOM and then we just like add in these characters with mutant abilities. Like they could have done that. They didn't. And I remain, not that I can't be convinced, but I still remain, despite having a good time so far, I remain skeptical of like, how does this feel 15 hours from now? I don't know.
Right. Because that's the thing I'm curious about, is that like a talky 60 is even harder for me than like, you got to be really good.
I think
at
you
that
can
talking.
Skip a lot of it though, right? So, and then that becomes a question of, well, then how good is the combat part of it? And I think to Rob's point, they're just being so, and maybe this is because they understand a broader audience is going to play this. They're going to see Marvel. And, you know, if you're unfamiliar with tactics games and you played Marvel Snap and you're like, now time to play Midnight Suns, I think you would have a hard time. Like the game's not, you know, it's not hard off the bat, but it's not a cakewalk either.
Well, and it's also just like conceptually, like there's a lot of like, what's this mean? Like there's a lot of cards. You're like, what's this going to do?
I've been using like, especially early on when I'm like, okay, there are no consequences here. Stop. We'll have a card off to the side, and like, I'm not really sure what the, like, what does this mean? Captain Marvel is going to draw enough cards until they have three, and then they can initiate binary mode. I don't. Okay, fine. I'll just play that card. Yeah, I don't. But they turn into a flame version of themselves.
It's Woodley mode.
Yeah,
Woodley mode sounds good, but yeah, and I think the other part of it too is, it is also pretty like. There's a lot of Marvel characters, like a lot of Marvel characters here. Like the cast of the MCU is a fraction of what's in this game.
Oh, this game is like so much more. I read a lot of comics in the 80s and 90s. Yes. And all my favorites are here.
And that's the other weird part is I think one thing that I find a little bit like that I'm finding a bit dislocating in it is I'm like, oh, I read a fair amount of comics, but like this is a lot. Like this is a lot of folks, and I don't really know how they all fit together. But like, I think there are people who do know how they all fit together and care deeply about this stuff. And like, I think more than anything that, like, that is who, like, if there's a prime demographic for Midnight Suns, I think it's that folks, right?
Yeah, like, I do like that. It doesn't feel beholden to the casting characters that are popular because of the films,
right.
And that. Even if it's taking cues from it, just like anything would that is made under Marvel's banner these days, it does feel like they open the library up and like, you know, fire is in, like not an X-Men in sight, right? Like there's been a, you know, there's no Wolverine, there's no Captain America, right? So like, yes, Tony Stark and Doctor Strange are here, but, you know, there's a different Ghost Rider. Like, I just like that at least up front, even if it feels a sort of odd, because I was like, I don't know what my connection is to these characters, and I'm not really sure of their origin stories in the game. You can get those, right? You can go talk to everyone and start piecing that stuff together. Essentially, you can do, like, rather than having a glossary or like a in-game Wikipedia, it's like you're getting that stuff by talking to these characters and asking if they would like to go for a stroll along the Abbey, Rob, and maybe I do. Do you know how havens work? Do you understand what the haven thing is?
No.
Yeah. Okay. Is that like a one-time use? If I use a haven once, do I need to use it once per day? I'm gonna need to ask Jake about this when we talk to him later today, because I'm about to finish the night cycle to go to the next day, and I'm not sure. Should I invite Doctor Strange to a haven? I don't know what that means.
There's this is when you discover it as a marriage mechanic, and you're like, oh no, I married Doctor Strange. Oh, there's no romance, but now I'm wed to this wizard. All right. So we will put a pin in Marvel Midnight Suns for now. Ren, as I understand it, you've also been playing some Extraction Schluters.
I'm deep in the Extraction Schluter paint. Right now, I've been playing Zero Sievert, which is a top-down stalker-esque extraction shooter that's single player. It is the open world version of Stalker, where it's like, all right, I'm gonna talk to this guy, and he's gonna be like, can you get me 10 pieces of meat? And you're like, yeah, sure. I'll go to the forest and get you your 10 pieces of meat, dude. You give him the 10 pieces of meat. And he's like, would you like a gun? And that game feels pretty good, honestly. I think it is doing, it's pretty early in early access, but it is doing cool stuff that I haven't actually really seen top-down shooters do before, which is neat. So for example, top-down shooters and like twin stick shooters as a whole, accuracy and weapons, kind of every weapon kind of ends up feeling the same because it's always kind of just spinning around and shooting a guy. And it doesn't feel like there's a huge, does not feel like actually putting the crosshair over the enemy is particularly important.
No, it tends to matter like spread and fall off. And that's exactly like kind of it.
So the way this game works is putting a crosshair directly over an enemy reduces the recoil of your weapon. And so there are moments where you're like, okay, cool, I can put my crosshair directly on this guy, reduce my recoil just a bit, and I can land these three shots versus like aiming 15 feet behind him and just being like, eh, these will probably hit. Like that is a big difference in recoil, where like actually taking your time to aim precisely before firing is a big deal. It's a game all about sight lines. And can you see through, for example, a forest you're fighting in, right? Can you see through these trees well enough to see like the four guys over there? I had one moment that felt very, very stalker-esque in the best way, where I was approaching this bandit camp at night, and I get there and I don't have a flashlight yet because I haven't bought a flashlight, and it's pitch black. I can barely see anything. And the enemies have flashlights, which means I can see them and they can't see me because I can see the beams of light coming from their flashlights. And so I am just dancing around this camp. Pop out, bop, 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 no one even sees me, and I'm gone before the flashlights can flick over to my position. And I take out, like, five guys that way, right? I end up looting this, like, really cool, really strong long-range rifle that can, like, one or two-tap most enemies. And then I go into this base, and again, all the lights are out. And so I go into this base, all the lights are out, and it's, again, just little bursts of gunfire in these rooms, lighting them up for just a second so I can see the enemies, I can see their flashlights, and then I disappear again. And going through that like little base like that is what really sold me on the game. Because to this point, I had been having the bad extraction shooter thing, like not bad, it doesn't mean that they're bad, but like the frustrating extraction shooter thing happen, which is you go in, you get a little bit of stuff, and then you just get fucking domed. And you're like, oh man, a bandit like really got me. Well, there goes all that shit I found. And the flow and rhythm of the combat hadn't clicked. But once it did, I was like, okay, cool. I am going to dismantle this base from the ground up in the way that you do in Stalker. And it actually like earns that comparison because you are juggling things the right way. There are interfactional conflicts in the right way, where you come across a group of soldiers who are opening fire on some bandits, and you fire to be like, oh, let me help out these soldiers, or for example, and you fire a couple of rounds and you take out the bandits, but one of your shots went wide and you hit one of the soldiers, and suddenly the whole thing falls apart and you're now dealing with a three-way fight between all of these characters in this like really digestible package. Because I think that like that is what separates this from something like Stalker, is that like going out in Zero Sievert and like doing a mission is pretty quick versus something like Stalker, where it's like you're going to be walking for 15 fucking minutes to get to where you're going to do your little objective. And it'll be fun. It'll be so fun to do that. You'll have a great time, but it's still a lot of time to be putting into that, like going out into the dark, getting your shit, coming back. Really nice, really digestible. I'm excited to see how it develops over time. I got it as part of a bundle of it and a couple of other early access games, including one I think, Rob, you played. Cantata, the strategy game?
I don't think I did get around
okay,
to
this
that.
I think this will be a Rob game once it comes out. Apparently, it's one of the best tactics games of the year. It's called a grand tactics game, is how they're describing it. It's basically a mix of grand strategy and actual traditional tactics. I'll just send you a screenshot, Rob, because I feel like this will improve your day. That's just a headline I wrote earlier. In addition to this, I have been playing, and I'm surprised to say this, Call of Duty Warzone 2. I have never really liked Call of Duty. It's never been my thing. I was a Halo kid growing up, pretty firmly. But I love extraction shooters, and so I have been trying out Warzone 2's DMV mode. Sorry, DMZ mode, not DMV mode. That's where you go to the...
DMV mode's the real nightmare.
Call of Duty, DMV. Can you pass this 15-question test?
Sorry, breaking. Email in my primary inbox. Costco winner. You are today's winner. It's spam. I'm not clicking that link. But I was really excited for a moment. Like, oh boy.
They heard
me. We were about to activate Kirkland's signature Rob Zachney.
So, DMV night mode engaged. yes. Yeah.
So, basically, it is a lot more PvE than I honestly expected, even by extraction shooter standards. It is a lot of PvE. I'm talking like you will take out 60 AI regularly in a mission, 60, 70, 80 AI, and like maybe two or three players. What you're doing is you're dropping into this big map. I think it might be the same map as traditional Warzone, or it's a slightly different map. Going to this big map, there are objectives everywhere that you can go do. You can do the stalker style, find an objective, pick it up, do your little mission, and then try and get out by extracting, by calling in a helicopter to pull you out, or you can stay until the end of the 25-minute match, at which point there will be the final exfil where you can basically fight other players for a bunch of really good rewards. I play a lot of extraction shooter solo because I don't really have like folks to play them with because and so I have been doing the solo Warzone experience, which is actually pretty good. When it's good, it's great. Turns out Call of Duty, they made the guns feel good. Crazy, right? And the actual encounter design is pretty solid. It uses the same health system as Warzone proper, where you are basically breaking levels of armor plating off of enemies. And so little grunts will go down in maybe one, two shots if you're like landing your shots correctly and getting headshots, and you can like clear out a camp pretty quickly. But if they're heavily armored, then that is going to be a fight. In a way that I think is really engaging.
No, it's the thing where like that fight is scary, not so much because the fight itself is hard, but like it will set off flags to other players.
It'll set off flags to other players, yeah. And you'll drain resources.
Right.
I was the shithead recently at a match I played a little bit before the podcast. I was the motherfucker because I heard some gunfire and I looked over to the northeast and I was like, wait a minute, I recognize that running is not NPC running. That is player running. And I had a rifle that is a marksman rifle. I didn't have a scope on it or anything because I'd lost all my good gear. My good gear gone because I got killed and I lost all that shit. So I just have this one marksman rifle. And I see this player like 100 meters, maybe like 120. And I'm like, I think I can make that shot. I don't think that guy notices me. I can make that shot. Bop, 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 dropped. Take out another player, third party their fight. And then I see their friend who has no fucking clue I'm there because they just know that their friend got dropped and they were fighting NPCs. So they have no idea that they're being third partied. Runs out, runs across this big field. I see the NPCs firing. I'm firing at the NPCs to like slow them down, right? Because I'm trying to make sure that guy gets to his friend. And he starts the res process. And then again, 150 meters, bop, bop, bop. Drop them, take their shit. Take the level 5 or whatever, like the really kitted out rifle that the game starts you with. Because this group of people's first round.
Oh, man.
And I think that because they had the really kitted out rifle that the game starts you with. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, bud. Well, now I have the cool, really kitted out rifle. I'm going to go about my day now. And then play it through for a little bit more. And then eventually, the main goal of the mode is to go to these strongholds where there are basically you have to find a stronghold key off of a random enemy. And then you go there and you fight a large group of NPCs and generally like a really strong NPC who is going to be effectively the boss of that stronghold. And then in strongholds, there is a bunch of good gear and then intel, which is going to unlock more missions, and more missions means you have like more ways to like unlock weapons and experience and all that other shit, right? I think it's a really competent extraction shooter, much to my deep dismay. I am mad that I like it.
I mean, it's very popular.
Yeah. No, I know. I know it is. And it's popular for good reason. I just also, my anti-Call of Duty bias is very strong. And it is a testament to the game that it is overcoming it.
Arguably, like, that pipeline is the only one that's reliably churned out, like, great multiplayer shooters in the space. Because, like, feels like their rivals have, like, I mean, Battlefield effectively is not a rival at this point.
No. And is a Battlefield Call of Duty like a Bears-Packers situation? Like, oh, we're a rival, but the other one just implodes and doesn't really count anymore?
And then, like, you know, Halo is fighting its own battle.
Please don't remind me. Please don't remind me that my...
Sorry, Halo kid, but in the end, you're coming home.
Well, they've released Forge. I should check out Forge. I'll check out Forge for the next episode.
People really like Forge. Like that, yeah, no shit.
But I mean, look, like extraction shooters are cool. And like, I can see that being combined with like what they got really good at doing with Warzone, being really compelling.
Yeah. It is compelling. I'm excited to try it out with other people because again, I pretty much exclusively, with the exception of Hunt, which I play with Matthew Galt, I pretty much exclusively play extraction shooters with just solo.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to actually try it out with other people and see how it changes the dynamics of fights because I think that it will change things significantly. If I am, you know, taking on, like, being able to do those group tactics of, like, okay, swing around this corner and, like, not having the dreaded situation at the end of an extraction shooter where you call the plane and you're waiting and you're waiting and you're waiting and then you see something in text chat or you hear something, you hear someone in proximity chat. Recently, I was playing and I saw a message go into the text chat that said, "There's one more inside." And I was like, "Oh no, I'm inside. I'm inside building. I hope I'm not one more." And then about 6 seconds later, I hear a door explode open as someone shoulder checks through it, swings in. I fire two shotgun shots. I drop them, but I'm using one of these, like, it's a breech loader. And so I breech it. Try to load my next two rounds in, and then two of their friends swing in directly behind, and I just get obliterated by three people. And so I managed to take out one of them, but then the other two just come in and light me the fuck up, and I am gone in an instant. Another favorite interaction I've had was when I was I park my car up on this cliff, and I take out this player by shooting them out of their car. So I put a shot through the windshield of their car, and they drop, and then I finish them off. And then another car swings in from off screen, and it is a third player who joins the situation, drives up the hill towards me, and I'm like firing shots into their windshield. And then I had left a car next to me, and so then they like pool ball this car down the hill. It stops them. They jump out of the car and use the crash to kill all of their momentum, jumped out of the car and just blasted me down with full armor. And so I was not able to break their armor fast enough because they had like the level 3 armor and I just got. But like, it is doing the thing that extraction shooters are best at, which is generating stories and moments like this where you're like, well, you got me, but also that was sick as fuck. That was rad as hell. The world in which I that fight with those three players goes the other way, I think about it for the next several weeks. Like if I get that W, that is like, that sells me on the game permanently. And so, yeah, I think it is. It's got a lot of potential.
It is interesting. Like the reception to Vanguard and the sales of Vanguard, while still big in the way that any Call of Duty is, felt like a real low point for the franchise. And was like, huh? Like, where are we going with all this? And it's wild 1 year later that Modern Warfare 2 is sold like just behind Elden Ring, and Warzone 2 hits, and all of a sudden Call of Duty is more relevant than ever. It's interesting.
All right. So our Our first mail comes in from Ethan. Ethan writes, Nintendo has still not released Advance Wars. Is that true? They still haven't? Or is they just, did I see something since this email came in?
It's not out. The war rages on in Ukraine, and thus Advance Wars also remains unreleased. I think at some point, even after, you know, the initial delay was clearly related to the conflict breaking out there, at some point Nintendo's schedule just got extremely busy. Like there just wasn't a slot for it anymore. And so my guess is that game comes out in the spring, roughly where it was supposed to originally, but just a year later.
But Ethan goes on, that is a turn-based strategy game with little tanks and artillery units that look like cute toys. Look up a trailer, you'll see what I mean. It's set in a world where the Black Hole Army is attacking the Orange Star Army. All participants are primary color-coded. But the Black Hole characters are Russian caricatures, so Nintendo is like, this is way too hot to touch, super poor taste, and refused to release the game. Activision Blizzard just released Modern Warfare 2. The weapon violence is extremely realistically depicted. It's set on real Earth, features real countries, including Russia and Iran. It's selling incredible numbers. So what's wrong here? In a vacuum, Nintendo's position of don't release video games about Russian invasion fun times while that is being inflicted on Ukraine seems more than reasonable. On the other hand, the market has spoken, and the market don't give a shit. Signed, Ethan. I mean, I think it's entirely about how these two companies position themselves, too. Like, I think Activision and Call of Duty have leaned in for years into evoking and playing off of things that are in the media, things that are sort of making their way out of war zones. And that is kind of, that has been the selling point. And that's something they've been happy to sort of tie themselves to. I think Nintendo's commitment to having a platform that is fundamentally about like escapism and like harmless fun makes them tread very carefully around this stuff, even though from this description of Advance Wars, this is the definition of like maybe excessive caution.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I ended up kind of giving my answer in the explanation on Advance Wars earlier, but I think it was I can't imagine they're doing a grand aesthetic revamping of this game, although I suppose it also wouldn't shock me if it came out on the other side and they'd done some sort of tweaks, given that the conflict between Russia and Ukraine is unlikely to be over anytime soon. But yes, I think you're right, Rob. I think this is a situation where Nintendo is just don't want to touch it, and so they won't. And I think the one of the few bits I saw out of the Modern Warfare 2 campaign was there's a situation where you're, I don't know what kind, some sort of neighborhood you're strolling through, and there's an option to de-escalate. And you press a button and you take your gun out and point it at people and you yell at them. And that's what the game's version of de-escalate is. And it's like, again, like that's the world this game is operating in. Like it just, it would have to rise to such a specific degree to derail Call of Duty or to give them any sort of pause on releasing it. And it also just makes so much money. Like, so, you know, I think that's Nintendo's a little more, they have more things they can throw at the wall than Activision does. They frankly don't release that many games. And so Modern Warfare has got to get out.
Let's see here. We've got, so somebody wrote in, just echoing, their Akata's enthusiasm for Rich Streets. So just people want everyone to know that Kato's on to something with what you can get from Rich Streets. Phil writes, my partner and I moved to one of those Rich Streets last year, and I can confirm that rich people do love to throw away nice things. The week after we moved in, we found 4 beautiful wooden dining room chairs that would have cost hundreds of dollars brand new. You know those fancy metal trash cans that cost $100 a Target?
Yeah.
We have 2, and we didn't pay a dime.
Damn!
We've expanded our home decor with art we like, and even a fiddly fig. I don't know what that is. Now, in fairness, I walk through our alleys almost daily. It's the most direct route to the park during walks. But my partner, the frequency and fervor with which she brings home abandoned treasure could make one question how far out of her way she goes during walks. I'm sure she's not trespassing, but she's brought back flowers that looked suspiciously fresh more than one time. I'm sure that's nothing to worry about, though. So I ask you, what is the best treasure you found dumpster diving or abandoned on the curb? Phil from DC.
Well, I mean, we definitely, when I was growing up, there was a Office Max. There was a Office Max next to a series of other stores, but the Office Max was the one that was the most important to the story that had this dumpster in the back, and they just threw everything in it. I mean, you could get like a working printer. We would go frequent enough, we like knew which dumpster to go to around the mall and other places and spots that they weren't putting trash into. They were just putting other things. And over time, would those places realize what we were doing and put locks on their dumpsters? Yes. Increasingly over time, dumpsters came off the map because they realized a group of high school students was just pilfering them. But then the Office Max one always, and it had this big, parking lot in the back that we would just basically hang out in until somebody came. So we'd like grab all this trash out of their dumpster, and then we'd like sort through it in this like parking area in the back until someone realized what we were doing. One of the favorites, this was just a dumb teenage behavior, but they would put the big fluorescent lights, like the big ones that look like a lightsaber when you carry them. Do you know what's one of the most satisfying things to break? One of those. They shatter into a bajillion pieces just instantly. And so, like, were we being dickheads smashing their broken lights, like, behind the Office Max? Yes. Was that profoundly satisfying to do? Also, yes. Also was very satisfying to smash. There was a dumpster not too far, like, an actual, like, or, like, not quite a landfill, but, like, I don't know what they did there. But they had big, you could go back there and break things and no one would know what you were up to, is to take an old CRTV. It was broken. Mm-hmm. And so whenever we'd find one, like that was just broken, we'd load it up into someone's car, take it back to this area, and smash it with a baseball bat. Like, the sound that thing makes while you collide through it, makes my heart sing.
I don't know if I've never been a real dumpster diver. I mean, one time my neighbors left a mirror that's in my room, but for the most part, I've never really... I haven't taken much. My roommate has suggested it, but it's just I don't know. Some stuff is just, people. I don't know. People could lick it. You know. I don't.
No, it definitely has cooties. Like it's like there's a. This is an obstacle for me, but I did overcome it when I found a matching set of dining room table chairs. Mm-hmm. Like I also had that experience of like, and not just that, it was made by the same like manufacturer that made my love seat. And so it matches, like, suddenly, oh, we have a decor, because it was the same type of upholstery. They're two complementary, like, they're the same material. And so now it's like, wow, this room looked really put together. And so, yeah, that was quite the score. Those days are gone. I never had the courage of my convictions, though, to go and loot the dumpsters at the colleges. In Boston, mm-hmm. when it was end of term in the summer. Books? No, for all the rich kids who were like just dismantling their dorms.
That's a good point.
And just like leaving behind tons of nice shit because they don't need it anymore. They don't want to move it. So this was like a huge part of the circle of life for furniture in like Cambridge was that, yes, like stuff would be basically cast off by wealthy undergrads, make their way to like grad students, and then filter their way out into the wider ecosystem in Cambridge.
Incredible.
That's really good. This isn't exactly related to the question, but brings to mind. We live like our neighborhood is a pretty standard, like sort of like middle, like slightly upper middle class, like suburban neighborhood. But we live across the street from a place where you just, they turn into little mansions. You just start adding zeros to the houses literally right across the street. And this is, other than just the houses look fancier, this was most acute in which So this is like six, nine months ago. I noticed there were like all these trucks going up and down the street, and they were digging holes. And I like looked up one of the little construction notices, and I was like, oh my God, AT&T is putting fiber in. I'm like, can I get out of the Comcast monopoly? Like, AT&T is also not great, but is this an option? And then I called, and it turns out they were expanding it to the rich neighborhood, and the dividing line was across the street. And so there's fiber across the street at the rich homes, but it didn't come across the street to us. So I need to go dig those up. Can I drag a fiber line across the street?
You need to bribe a cable guy. Yeah.
Furious.
Emilio writes, longtime listener, first time emailer. I'm Emilio, a plumber from Santiago, Chile. I've been playing games since I was 7 years old, and one thing that always surprises me is the way I remember the graphics of certain games. In the mid-90s, I used to eagerly await for Saturdays in the afternoon to watch a TV show about video games. It was the only way for me to access any video footage about games. The game that really caught my eye was Pitfall for the 16-bit consoles. The animation was incredible for me at the time, and the CRT TV made it look incredible. Another one a few years later was Medal of Honor Allied Assault. To my eyes accustomed to PS1 graphics, it looked like real life. Sadly, when you see them now, they look dated in different ways. So my question is, what old game comes to your mind as an example of this, one that impressed you at the time, and even if they now look dated, you hold on to that memory of the first impression?
Halo 3 ODST. The opening, Halo 3 ODST was the first M-rated game I ever saw and like played. But it was also the opening segment of that game in New Mombasa is incredibly well lit. It is like the lighting is great. They are really getting the most out of their art design. And I remember being just like completely fucking floored the first time I saw it.
I think for me, like there was a time growing up where, you know, back in the era where video games, especially in Japan, did not immediately, there was no simultaneous worldwide release. Games could come out 6 months, a year longer if they came out at all. And the Nintendo 64 was an example of that, in which Super Mario 64 and the Nintendo 64 launched in Japan much earlier than it came out over here, and there was a movie theater that we frequented that had a import store next to it. And I remember what movie we were going to see, because it didn't matter, because when I walked in the import store, I found that they had imported a copy of Super Mario 64, a game that I had just essentially been dreaming about and like looking at screenshots of in EGM, and it was there, and they were charging money for it. You had to pay, I don't know what it was, but some amount of $10 to get 10 minutes with Super Mario 64. And so I just have like this real, like really imprinted memory of, and I've revisited that game. I reviewed the collection that Nintendo put out on the Switch, 2 years ago that included, a pretty much untouched Mario 64. And that game, you know, doesn't hold up especially well, but that memory of experiencing three dimensions in a platformer for the first time in this import store next to a movie theater. Yes. It's like, I will never be able to replace that memory. And it's one I treasure quite a bit. Cause it was one of those, I think this is rarer and rarer in video games, but it can happen in ways big and small, but to sit and touch a controller and realize, oh, everything's about to change. Like to have that happen in an instant was such a cool moment.
Gosh, I think
Die Hard Game Club. I think that's what the import store was. They used to have a magazine. That was also, I think that's where the Die Hard magazine came out of, was Die Hard Game Club. Sorry. Continue, Rob.
No worries. Yeah, I mean, there's so many games that sort of fit this bill. I think for me, a thing that I definitely mark the years by is sim games. Like, because the thing is, in some ways, Sims could be on the cutting edge of things because you They could deal. They didn't have to show very much on screen. Like, for instance, there was a series I played. It was the Jane's series, basically, is what it was called. But I remember when screenshots of this stuff came out. Yeah, it was like, it looks like holy hell. Like, these fighter jets look 100% real. Like, they've got the correct decals, markings, all this stuff. They just look, you know, you see contrails coming off them. You can see little pressure waves forming on wings under high load. Every screenshot is just like, well, this is incredible. Like, this is astonishing. There's nowhere for game graphics to go, really. It's not going to get better than this. And now you go and you look at the stuff and it looks, you know, cartoonish and blocky, and the decal stickers are just like weird little smudges on the airframe, and then your imagination kind of did the rest. And that's sort of how when I look back at racing games like IndyCar Racing 2, I also remember that being a game where, wow, they perfectly depicted what IndyCars at the time looked like. No, they didn't. But they were able to get so much more detail than you were used to seeing, and you knew the referent objects that they were using, that like my memory just completely bridges the gaps between like the video game and then what it was they were modeling. Like, mm-hmm. You know, it completely read as a one-to-one depiction of the cars I was watching, like, week to week in IndyCar Racing, and then you go back to it and nope, blocky, low res. There's so many parts of the model that they just don't have they don't have the polygons to spend on it, so it looks like shit. But I don't remember any of that when I think about them in the abstract.
Can I give the inverse of this? When I was playing Silent Hill 2 recently, that game is extremely beautiful. There are moments in Silent Hill 2 that, like, just the texture work and is so phenomenal that it felt like I was looking at something from, at the very least, the 360 era. It was I was just thrilled. It's such a beautiful game, and that is the inverse of the, oh, it's not as good as I remember it, and instead just being absolutely flabbergasted by how fucking good that game looks.
I love to hear that, though. It's so good to have the inverse happen. All right, I just got a kick out of this. So Gabe, remember I talked about, like, one of my little treats is popcorn?
Mm-hmm.
Gabe is out here trying to change our lives. Hey, Waypoint Dexters.
Our lives?
Maybe my life. The recent popcorn talk activated my conditioning. I had to reach out to inform you of the majesty of the Whirly Pop, a specialized corn-popping pot that you use on the stove. Sure. You can pop popcorn in virtually any pan, but the Whirly Pop is essentially a stovetop consumer version of the popcorn poppers used by movie theaters. It's essentially a pot with a hinged lid and a rotating crank that you use to constantly stir the popcorn kernels so they don't burn as they pop. My family, popcorn enthusiasts all, exclusively ate stovetop popcorn growing up, and as a result, I can't stand either microwave popcorn.
Can't stand or most is such that's that,
most
you know,
of the pre-pop
that's such
stuff.
A strong statement.
Although I do love that flavor blasted cheddar stuff. A popper is $20 to $30, which is a worthwhile investment.
$37.24. So
because popcorn kernels themselves are so cheap, for around $40 total, you can get a popper, a pound of popcorn kernels, and a thing of coconut oil, and have hot movie theater style popcorn whenever you want for months. And since it's not pre-portioned, you can pop exactly as much corn as you want. It takes a little longer than the microwave, and you do have to stand there turning the crank the whole time, but I will gladly exchange 4 minutes of time for delicious popcorn. I can't even pretend this is a question. I just wanted to evangelize my popcorn snobbery. Fuck turfs, fuck capitalism, go home and eat popcorn. Patrick, you were looking this up. Are you intrigued? Does this look like a gadget, a gizmo, that you could be convinced to buy?
No, I'm not going to sit there and turn it for 4 minutes, but I can imagine Rob doing it.
I'm going to buy one.
Yes.
Yeah. No, how much are they? 40?
$40.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, easy. Not even going to think about it.
So here's the other thing, because I may need something like this because I have found Achilles heel for the induction range.
Okay.
For whatever reason, it can't do popcorn well at all. There's something going on. I don't know what it is, but like tons of popcorn kernels do not pop. The failure rate is like enormously high. When doing it in the induction range, and it never was with the radiant heat one, and obviously, like doing it over flame is really easy. So something's going on, but maybe this will solve that issue with that sort of the cranking and the keeping the kernels from burning, so you can always make sure that things are coming back into contact with heat. I think that sounds great. I'm all in. Give me the biggest whirly pop they make.
Wow, took a lot of convincing. You turn a crank and you get popcorn. All right, here's my $40.
All right. If it doesn't work, it's only $40. Uh-huh. But it's $40 to see if I could be like living better, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when you put it that way, Rob, I mean, it'd be criminal not to buy it.
Wait, there's one I had marked out here. Okay. Last question, and we're a bit late to this, but never mind. Dear Wadacted, I'm starting a new job on November 1st. It's a small law firm of less than 10 people, all with their own offices. How soon can I ask my new boss, if it's okay, to bring my dog to work with me? What's the best way to go about it? My dog is a corgi, loves people, doesn't bark, and doesn't have accidents. Love y'all. Love the community. Fuck capitalism. Go home. And sincerely, Razgrease 2 and Stein, the corgi. For background, I've worked from home for the past 5 years since we adopted him when he was a little under 2 years old. I don't like the idea of leaving him home for a full workday or paying someone to only walk him once during lunch. I feel like this is a long shot, to be honest.
Really?
Like, if this is not a service dog,
yeah,
this is a very long shot. Because, like, one, there's some people who just don't like dogs or aren't comfortable around them.
And, might be allergic. Like,
those
like
people
me.
Could be in your office. Yeah, exactly. And, like, this complication is not something people want. Two, I am sure Stein's a very good corgi. I have not met the corgi who would not be an agent of chaos in an office environment. Like, literally, I have a couple neighbors who have a very nice corgi, seems very sweet, very very well-mannered, destroyed literally thousands of dollars of furniture within like 3 months of being adopted because they're clever, they're smart, and they can be enormously destructive. So like they combine destructiveness with ability to mask it and like conceal what they are doing, you do not discover until they've inflicted devastation.
Well, and even on a more basic level, like how does your dog act in crowds of people? And your version of, well, they're very good. Does that mean they're like constantly going and begging for attention from everybody around them, but they're very nice about it? I'm sorry, I don't need that when I'm working. Don't need that when I'm working. Allergies.
Much though, I would love it.
Right. Right.
Yeah, it's
like fundamentally different when a dog like is in a house or apartment or whatever with you and is broadly calm because it's you and that's the only source of distraction. Like it's so easy to imagine that going not like awry where they're even not causing damage or shitting all over the place, but just generally are looking for attention because why wouldn't they? Like there's lots of people to get pets from. And I could just see that.
That being said, if you have to try, and I understand that you probably do have to try, I would start out by being like, oh no, the dog daycare is closed. Can I bring my dog in for the afternoon?
The trial run.
Yeah. try some trial runs, do some good, like, see how it goes. Be open to the idea that
I think that is the right route to go. Because then you'll know off the bat whether it's not possible at all, right? And they'll be like, sorry, you're going to have to figure out something else. Then okay. You haven't asked, can this dog live here full time with me while I work?
Yeah.
which might rub your new employers the wrong way as an ask.
Because I've seen the office dog thing work out, but this was a dog that was enormously well trained and mostly like curled up on a dog bed next to its owner for the entire workday.
When I worked at One Up, Kathleen Sanders had a dog, Minnie, rest in peace, just passed away a little recently. Enormously well trained, just like sat in her lap in a bag all day long, and so
yeah.
That part worked just fine. And I sat across from Kathleen, and despite being allergic, it wasn't a big deal because it was a tiny dog, sat in a bag all day, was just a delight to be around. But I feel like that's a tall order to ask a dog, could you just not do anything for 8 hours?
I mean, I don't know. I've seen good office dogs. I've interacted with plenty of good office dogs. I think the climbing gym I go to actually has a dog. You got the climbing gym dog. You got the bodega cat.
Those are different environments, though. Like, I'd be delighted to meet an animal at a climbing place versus like I'm at my desk and I have like 3,000 words to write.
The other thing, though, I am sympathetic to the like. It's like I'm worried my dog's just going to be
fully
bored
that.
And miserable.
Yes.
And this is what like dog daycares are worth looking into. It is worth seeing about getting them in one that they like and making that like sort of a regular part of their life. It's expensive, but it's not like sending a kid to daycare.
No, expensive. It's not that expensive. I can tell you what my bill is on that.
Yeah, we're talking like hundreds a month, not like thousands. So that would be my recommendation, is if it does not seem like you will be able to get a full-time office dog arrangement, look like scout some daycares in your area, try it out, and you'll feel a lot better
about a lot of those places have cameras and stuff, right? Stuff you can like log into and like see what your dog is up to. It's not, you know, not every place has that, but I know a lot of my friends, so when they like board their dog, or even if it's not daycare, it's like there's a way for them to check on how they're doing if that's going to give you anxiety.
All right, that will do it for today's episode. If you want more from Waypoint, you can follow us on Twitter at Waypoint, on Facebook and YouTube, Waypoint Vice. You can follow me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where are you?
At Patrick Klopik.
Ren.
At Ren or Raven.
You can check out what we've published on waypoint.vice.com. Please read my review of Pentiment. And thanks to our Waypoint Plus listeners, we've been able to have a bunch of fun streams lately. Motorsports Monday continues apace. We've had some we didn't have any epic wins, but we had some epic podiums that I think we can all be very proud of. Patrick's been continuing his run in Cyberpunk, and I don't know what our schedule looks like for Thanksgiving week. There's probably going to be some disruptions coming up, but stay tuned. Hopefully we'll have some fun stuff coming up. All that is made possible by Waypoint Plus. Let's see. This week, Waypoint Plus listeners are going to be able to hear us talking about Hail Caesar.
That's already out. Let's do it right now.
Yeah. It's already in our Plus listeners' feeds. And next week, they'll be able to hear the manhunting episode on Miami Vice with Alex and Dia. If that sounds good, or you just want more Waypoint, you can go to waypointplus.com and subscribe. Not only do you get access to our premium feed, but you're also helping support Waypoint and everything else we do here. And if you want to show not just support, but zeal, go to waypointgeneralstore.com and buy some of our fine Waypoint merch. Our theme music is by Bowen. The track is Miss You off the EP Hail Machine. Learn more at waypoint.zone/BOEN. For now, we're calling time on this week. We will talk to you again next week. Till then, fuck capitalism. Go home.
Oh.